Why would a serious business newspaper, such as the Wall Street Journal, publish on its front page, above the fold, such quirky stories as translations of the Bible into Klingon, a Chinese restaurant that serves fresh lettuce seed rat stew, a golf tournament played up a mountain slope in a blizzard? But all these stories do appear on the front page. They're called A-heads. They began, irreverently enough, on December 17, 1941, 10 days after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The A-heads were meant to invite the reader in, to give them surcease from the sorrows and afflictions associated with banking and the stock market and the affairs of commerce. They were meant to be so light that, in the words of their creator, a former editor, they should float off the page. Now comes Floating Off the Page, the best stories from the Wall Street Journal's middle column. The book's editor and a former A-head writer is Ken Wells, a senior editor at the paper. He joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York, and joining us here in Washington is novelist Geraldine Brooks, a longtime and former correspondent for the Journal. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Hi, Jackie.
So why does the Wall Street Journal publish these stories, which, you know, may be surcease from sorrow, but are not perhaps, you know, what we expect of good journalism?
Well, the good thing is about 60 years ago when Barney Kilgore created this, people thought he'd lost his mind. You know, the Journal was a stock tip, you know, a very dry thing that was basically a trade rag for stockbrokers. And Barney Kilgore was 30 years old and came in as this prescient managing editor and decided he wanted to bring a whiff of the literary to the paper. And he told the staff to stop writing for bank presidents and start writing for depositors. You know, there were a lot more depositors than there were bank presidents.
Mm-hmm. What was the first story?
The very first story was a story that we actually could have run not very long ago. It was about a shortage of flags at the outbreak of World War II.
Just look at these stories. Most of them are so charming. I mean, you have stories in here about orthodontics for sheep and how to throw a grand piano from a medieval catapult. And I think your own contribution is remarkable, playing golf in a blizzard up a mountain in Alaska.
I think I was doing what we call reporting from the Mahogany Ridge. You know, I was sitting in the bar one night. And heard
the Mahogany Ridge is the bar. I like that.
Well, I do a lot of my reporting from the Mahogany Ridge. I get a lot of my best A-head ideas from those. And anyway, I was sitting around, and I actually ran into a guy who was in transit, and I said, "Well, where are you going?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to Kodiak, Alaska, to participate in a golf tournament." And all I knew about Kodiak, Alaska, is that it had brown bears that ate people from time to time. And I said, "Well, I didn't realize they played golf in Kodiak." And he said, "Well, it's a special kind of thing, but it's a one hole par 70 course played up the side of a bear-infested mountain, usually in the snow." And and I said, "Well, I'd like to go too." And so I spent three fairly hilarious days, you know, following crazos around. This is golf played with axes and saws and a compass, because there was ice fog all over the course, you know, and you could easily get lost, and a lot of liquor, and the liquor was for courage, you know, to get yourself up and down the mountain.
Would you read us just a bit from your piece? It's called Golfing in the Spring, One Hole, Par 70.
Professional Golfers Association tournament rules apply, with exceptions for local conditions. Golfers must play the balls where they lie or forfeit a stroke. But players are allowed to carry hatchets and handsaws to clear away thickets, and can tote snow shovels to probe for lost shots and topple shot-blocking snowbanks. Bending the rules seems to be rampant and is generally tolerated if cleverly executed. One example, last year, a player whose shot landed in the caddy's backpack 50 yards downrange was allowed to retrieve his ball from the backpack, technically a violation, and played it from the top of a bottle sticking up from the pack.
You know, so much of what happens in these stories are the things that people really do remember forever, and you couldn't invent them. They're great details. Geraldine, I know that as a longtime Middle East correspondent, you did all sorts of stories of true import. The Gulf War, the First Intifada, profiles of Queen Noor, all these kinds of things, interviews with the king.
Jackie, are you saying that belly dancing is not of true import? This is a catastrophe for Egyptian cultural life.
Actually,
the rise of Islamic fundamentalism has had many consequences, as we know. But one of them has been that Egypt isn't granting any licenses to new belly dancers. So I decided to fill the breach.
Would you please read from Being Hip in Cairo?
When Ashgan, the belly dancer, thrusts her ample hips, a tidal wave of flesh undulates across her midriff. As she shifts her weight in a little leap from left to right, the thud registers on the Richter scale. Turbaned Egyptians bang the tables in delight. Ashgan's figure is beyond Rubenesque. She is, to be blunt about it, a whale. Pausing in mid-shimmy, she reaches for a Kleenex from a box on a front row table, blows her nose noisily, and stuffs the used tissue into the cavernous cleavage of her spangled bra. Ashgan does not exactly look like a hard act to follow, except for one small problem. I am the next act.
What was it like being on stage with Ashgan the whale?
Well, it was better than being on stage alone, which happened first. I did an encore with Ashgan, and she was great. She knew how to work an audience and what a good punchline was. So she would kind of dance with me as you do, kind of going, as it were, belly to belly. And then she ostentatiously peered down the front of my costume and yelled out to the audience in Arabic, "Mafish," which means nothing there.
What are some of your other favorites in the book, Geraldine?
I think one of my favorites is not humorous at all. It's the story of Otter number 76, and this was by Charlie McCoy, and it was the aftermath of the Valdez oil spill.
And he is one of the...
He chronicles the attempts to save the otters from the effects of the oil, and it's just the most moving story. He just makes you care so much about these creatures and what they're going through. It's told with the rhythm and pacing of a real tragedy.
I think that there are a number of things in here that work that way. Tony Horowitz's story about sitting with snipers overlooking Sarajevo, Serbian snipers, and talking to one of them about the Jewish writer Isaac Bashevis Singer works that way. There's another piece, quite an older piece from 1970, about Laos, and it's allegedly about the Laos Navy, which sounds ridiculous because it's a landlocked country with nothing but rivers. The piece really goes on to say how vulnerable this country is in the chess match that's being played in Southeast Asia. Ken, want to sign off with a favorite story from the Annals of the Aheads?
Well, one of my all-time favorites, it's a fairly contemporary story, actually only written last year by probably the best pure A-head writer on the paper, a guy named Barry Newman, and the title is The Fat Man Cometh, but it actually is a very kind of weirdly serious piece about the national sewer fat crisis. Now, I know you don't know about this, and it's another one of these things that we just have to learn to worry about, but, you know, it turns out that in every major American city, restaurants are dumping deep fat fryer grease down the sewers. And all over America, the sewers are getting heart attacks. We're having municipal sewer heart attacks all over the nation because, you know, like arteriosclerosis, the deep fryer fat is gumming up the works. And this is a national scandal and a national crisis.
This is the kind of guy he is. He actually got onto this story because he was pondering, given that everything is fat-free now, where has all the fat that they've freed gone?
The book is called Floating Off the Page, The Best Stories from the Wall Street Journal's Middle Column. It's edited by Ken Wells, and he joined us, as did Geraldine Brooks. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you, Jackie.